Welcome to Our Voices, Our Future, the podcast where we amplify the voices driving change and equity within medicine and beyond. Brought to you by the Gender Equity Task Force, a committee of the American Medical Women's Association, we're here to challenge norms, break barriers, and ignite conversations that matter. I'm your host, Laura Uricochea, and in each episode, we'll bring you candid discussions with leaders, changemakers, and advocates working to create a more inclusive and just world. No more silence, no more waiting. You're listening to Our Voices, Our Future. Let's get into it. Dr. Helfman is an emergency medicine physician working in the Pediatric Emergency Department at Ms. Wenger Children's Hospital in Johnson City, Tennessee. In addition to her clinical work, she supervises residents in pediatrics and family medicine. She also serves as adjunct faculty at AB Tech in Woodfin, North Carolina, where she teaches advanced paramedic courses focused on pediatric EMS transfer. She is an AHA instructor in PALS, ACLS, and CPR, and currently serves as co-chair of the American Women's Hospital Service. Dr. Helfman earned her undergraduate degree from Barnard College and her medical degree from the Medical College of Pennsylvania. She completed her residency at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. She also trained in wilderness medicine as both a wilderness first responder and wilderness advanced life support provider, and is a lead instructor for Wilderness Medical Associates. On any given day, you might find her working a shift in the emergency department, teaching wilderness medicine, or guiding a whitewater rafting trip. Welcome, Dr. Helfman. It's so nice to have you here with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So as I mentioned during the introduction, you wear many hats, but I kind of wanted to start with one that caught my attention. You work as a whitewater raft guide. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure, love to. Whitewater and paddling became a part of my life early on when I was about 12, which is interesting because I grew up in New York City. But my parents sent us to summer camp, and through a variety of coincidences, I took a river course in canoeing instead of a swimming course, which had to do with having had a concussion, but we won't get into that. So I just developed a love of moving water and rivers. And as my years of training went by, whenever I could take the opportunity to go down a river in a canoe, primarily at first, I would do it. During med school, I heard about a company in North Carolina that was a leader in whitewater. And when I went down there to take a course, I found out that many of the instructors were lawyers and accountants and veterinarians and accomplished professionals that just really wanted to have whitewater and nature as part of their life. So I decided I would do that. And that's kind of what drew me there. It took a few more years to finish residency and to get some loans paid off. But then I started doing that as a part-time thing. And then also figured out that I could do locum tenens, which is part-time work, temporary work, so to speak, and continue to do whitewater. So I continue to do whitewater as a fairly full part of my my activities.
I think that's such an interesting hobby and career. You've been doing it for so many years on the side, and I thought that was very cool. That's why I wanted to start with that. And
sure.
You're still doing it, right?
I am. I think this makes 33 years.
Oh, wow.
Which is almost as long as I've been a doctor, but not quite as long.
That's amazing. And you also are involved in wilderness medicine. What inspired you to pursue that, and how did you get involved with Wilderness Medical Associates?
I think it's all part of that. I came to work as a guide, and the company was using the Wilderness Medical Associates, which is based in Maine, as a means for training their guides in first aid. There's, of course, Red Cross and American Heart teach a basic first aid, but when wilderness guides are out on rivers or hiking, they don't necessarily have access to, nowadays they would have access to 911, but back then there were no cell phones. So they really had no access to asking for help, and anyway, they might be in an inaccessible place. So companies like Wilderness Medical Associates came about to fill that void. Started out, they were teaching Outward Bound instructors. So my company that I ultimately went to work for when I first started guiding was using Wilderness Medical Associates as their training facility. So I met some of those instructors who were also river guides. And it just seemed like a natural extension to become an instructor with them. And Wilderness Medical Associates is to be distinguished from Wilderness Medical Society, which is a professional society, which is also a really cool organization that I belong to, but I'm not very active. So Wilderness Medical Associates, WMA, teaches lay people wilderness skills up to and including reduction of joints, shoulder joints that might be dislocated, a common outdoor problem, to clearing cervical spines, sort of advanced training, but not yet, not exactly paramedic. In fact, there are some things that wilderness first responders can do that paramedics can't. So I got into teaching for them, but wilderness medicine is just fascinating because it marries my interest in medicine with my interest in the outdoors. And it has come in handy. My husband has been my rescuer during one of our expeditions in the Everglades when I got pretty sick. And he was able to use his training to figure out what was wrong and help treat it.
Wow. Yeah. And it must be such a also good skill to have as a whitewater raft guide and to be able to train other people in that.
I keep it sort of silent because I don't want people in the raft to be so interested in my other career that we don't talk about what we're doing there. And when the guides have a medical issue, I try to get them to solve through it instead of automatically yelling out, doctor, doctor, we need you. So, so yes, it's true. It's good that I'm there, but I try to get the guides to do what they can and then ask for my help.
Yeah, that makes sense. You've stayed connected to women's institutions throughout your training and career, from attending medical college in Pennsylvania to joining AMWA, and you now serve as co-chair of AWHS. What drew you to these spaces, and how have they shaped your perspective as a physician and advocate?
It actually started prior, when I started at Barnard College, which was... it was one of the colleges I interviewed at. It actually wasn't my top choice because I wasn't sure I would want to go to a women's college. So this was back in the 70s, and things were kind of getting to be more equal. And I just wasn't sure that was my path, but my father's union had very good scholarships to certain select schools. The other one on the list was Princeton, which I didn't get into. And in retrospect, I would not have liked Princeton. Barnard turned out to be a really good choice because I was a very shy and book learning kind of person. I wasn't very outgoing. And I think that going to a women's college brought that out. And then the feminist movement was going on. So I got involved with some of the issues we thought we were solving, which we obviously haven't because of what's gone on recently in our country. But we were the first generation to be the recipients of Roe v. Wade, and we're working on other issues. So I think that the choice of going to Barnard was a good one, but not by choice or not by philosophical choice. And then by that time, Medical College of Pennsylvania, as a formerly women's college, women's med school, did interest me. And it was, again, probably the best college I got into that was private. And back in the day, private schools and public schools did not have such a vast economic disparity. So for a little bit more than going to Rutgers, I could go to this school, which had a women's identity and it was a private school. And it turned out to be a great place for me to be. AMWA was fairly prominent there. And so I joined readily. And I think it was my second year, the Alumni Association offered us some money to go to a national meeting. So I went with some other of my friends, and I don't know, circumstances were such that I met a lot of the women there, and they became my mentors, and then I became a student activist. I think the student, they didn't call it student president back then, they called it student co-chair. And I ran and I won, and I did that for a year, and stayed on, and then was on a couple of different committees, and eventually settled on the AWHS, which is American Women's Hospital Service, which is the charitable arm of AMWA. Never really intending to wanting to be leadership, but the other ones, they're not here anymore. I mean, they were old, they're gone. And so I became the most natural choice to become co-chair. So here I am. It's nice to be involved with global health, but it's tough because it's totally volunteer. So yeah. Every year when I say, yes, I'll do it again, I'm like, oh, you know, but it's fun. You meet, at least in paper, you meet the applicants, you see what they're about to do when they travel. We have two main clinics that we help support, and I know the founder of one of them quite well and see him when he comes to the States. He's from Nepal. And our other co-chair knows the founder of the one in Uganda, Inge, quite well. So it's kind of a nice addition to a rounded life. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your role as co-chair of the AWHS?
Sure. So how much time do we have? Because AWHS could use a little further explanation if we have the time.
We have the time.
Okay. So AWHS was founded in 1917 by a group of women doctors. Women started going into medicine in the late 1800s as apprentices, and then eventually my school founded in 50s, 60s, and then there were 10 or 12 others. So around World War I, there were actually a decent number of women doctors, considering the times. And they had just formed the AMWA. And then a bunch of the doctors wanted to go to Europe and help with the war effort. But the U.S. government said that the concept of a woman doctor didn't exist. So they said, well, you could come as a nurse, but we have no place for you as a commissioned doctor. So many of them decided to go to Europe and just do medical care. They opened hospitals, they built clinics, and they took care of primarily women and children. And back in the day, those women doctors had rich American women patients who were able to give endowments, and they actually got a whole lot of money. And that could be a podcast in itself about AWHS. So it continued along over the years, actually, with American women doctors going to places, eventually China, various other places in the world. But at this point, we're more of a foundation. So we do fundraise. We have a very small endowment that's invested. And then we provide help to the two main clinics are one clinic Nepal in Magali, Nepal, and the other one in, forget what its name is, but it's in Uganda. And then we have grants from other clinics that we have done occasionally, but those two are the primary. And then somewhere in the 90s, the current chair said, we should provide money for medical students and residents who are our members to get a global health experience. So they developed a travel grant assistance program or overseas assistance travel program. And I wound up being the first recipient. I wound up going to Bolivia, La Paz, Bolivia, to work with a clinic that they were currently supporting. So now we administer both the funds that go to the clinics, and also students and residents can apply for an overseas assistance grant. It's not much. If they don't have other funds, they're not going to be able to go with our measly stipend, but it helps. And then we have a community grant program, which is for smaller grants for someone to develop a project that helps women and children in the health field. They've done projects on menstrual health and general female health. So many things. It's all on the website. But so we administer all that. We get the applications, and then 4 times a year we review them and decide who we can grant and, unfortunately, who we can't. So that's the biggest part of what we do. We would like to do more, but fundraising is tough in this day and age. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it's totally volunteer. So AMWA picks up some of the small costs of administration, but we like to say 100% of our donations go to our work. And so that means we have no staff. So that's what we do. And anyone who's listening who is a member of AMWA, for the travel grants, it has to be second. You have to have completed your second year before you can be eligible. You can apply beforehand, but you can't travel till then. And for community grants, there's no restriction. So anyone could go to the AMWA website, navigate to the AWHS subsection, and look at all that.
That's really amazing.
And we fix the website constantly. We fix the website to be consistent with our rubric and vice versa. It's a never-ending battle.
That's really cool that you got involved with that. And I think you're doing some amazing work with that, and also providing the opportunity for other medical students to get some of the additional funds that they need to be able to carry out projects that they're interested in. You've taken on so many roles: physician, rafting guide, disaster responder, educator, advocate. How do these parts of your life complement each other, and how do you find balance?
Well, they complement because it's easy to get burned out on anything you do all the time. I'm graduating med school in 85, so I'm 40 years since graduation. And I can tell you that those fellow students of mine that I keep in touch with, which is not that many because that's how life goes, they're burnt out. They're either retired and couldn't wait to leave, or they're burnt out, or they otherwise don't look back. And it's easy to have some issues with the profession, especially because there have been so many restrictions and changes. Really, the last 20 years have been so dramatically different than the first 20 years in terms of regulations and all kinds of things. But I never really developed that significant burnout, because as the winter would end and I knew that I was maybe going to be on the river either half or full time, because many summers it was full time, then I didn't mind the ER as much. And as the river season was winding down and I got tired of some of the silly questions that tourists will often ask, like, is the water wet? Literally, or does the river go in a circle? Then I was ready to go back to the ER. The disaster response, and we actually didn't talk about all of it, because there's the wilderness response, which I primarily do as an educator, but I also belong to disaster management assistance team, which was part of FEMA. It's still in existence, but I don't think it's part of FEMA. And that's medical professionals as a team. My team's in Tennessee, being asked by the government to go to places. So the last place I went, I joined the California team, and I was in Asheville, which is where I live. But I was in basically a MASH unit outside of the hospital, doing as much of the care as did not need a hospital. So that just seemed like a natural response of doing medicine and doing wilderness medicine, because it's sort of a blend of those. Now, we were working right next to a hospital, so if someone had an injury to their extremity and we really wanted an x-ray, they actually had a portable machine and we could actually get the x-ray, which wouldn't be the case if you went to a disaster like Katrina, where there was no resources. And my team did actually go to Katrina way in the way back. So I don't know. I guess a desire to do some good instead of just making a living kind of made all of that make sense. I think the wilderness part was not only born from a love of the river and the outdoors, but also, unfortunately, I lost my mother when I was 28 to cancer. And I just saw some doctors burning themselves out. And so I sought that out to not be so married to medicine that I had nothing else. And luckily, the medical profession, the residents I teach, the younger doctors that I work with, luckily have developed that insight. You know, it's a thing now to have work-life balance. No one would have talked about work-life balance when I was in med school. It wasn't a thing.
Yeah, so. I really appreciate that we talk a little bit more about that. And mm-hmm. I think the residents that get to work with you are really fortunate, because one thing is saying that you need work-life balance, but you're also like a living example for them mm-hmm. of work-life balance. So it must be very inspiring for them.
It's very common for me to pick up my phone while we're talking about it and find some pictures just to show them. And some have been river rafting, but whether they have or not, it's kind of nice to show them. I like it.
Yeah. And you're also showing them that having multiple interests and not focusing just on medicine and just on your work also gives you purpose, and as you said, prevents burnout, and you can keep enjoying all the things that you do.
This brings to mind part of my reason that I went into clinical medicine has to do with some of what happened with my mother, which occurred during college, med school, and internship. From a standpoint of being a female patient with a female problem, she didn't at first have physicians that were sensitive to that, which was how it was. So I had vowed, because I was still a junior in college when she was diagnosed, when some of the less pleasant things were witnessed, that I vowed that I would save women from these male doctors that didn't understand. And so I really thought I was going to go into women's health, and not necessarily to be an OBGYN, although that was a possibility. But then the circumstance of her illness, which dragged on for 10 years, caused me to stop after internship and just work as a urgent cares and whatnot, which is no longer possible. But back then you could get an internship, get a license and work. So there was a 4-year gap when I didn't want to be in training so that I would have as much time to devote for her as needed, which was, of course, invaluable. And by the time those 4 years had gone by, I had gotten into Whitewater, and I'm like, OBGYN seems like it's more commitment than I want to do given these other interests. So my choice of ER actually came about because of wanting to have that balance, which would have been harder in women's health. But sometimes I regret that I didn't get more involved in the women's health space other than AMWA, you know, more in a, especially with what's going on now. You know, we just need so much advocacy for women's health as we're dealing with the challenges of the current administration.
Yeah, I agree. But I think that just you as a preceptor, for example, for your current residents, I think you're also doing a lot of work just inspiring other women, which I think it's also great work that we need to see more.
I hope so.
So balancing a multidimensional life comes with challenges, especially for women in medicine. Have you encountered any particular obstacles, whether in the form of gender bias or expectations placed on you as a woman?
I have to say, considering that I'm very attuned to it, less than a lot of other women that I've met. There were a couple things that I spoke out about in med school and residency, sometimes successful, sometimes not. And there were a couple times I spoke up because of a racial bias that I witnessed, going to the neurosurgeon, making an appointment and telling him how inappropriate I thought it was, but it didn't go anywhere. But I didn't get kicked out either. But relative to many of the women that I've met at AMWA over these 40 years, relatively little. I don't know if I just gave off, considering I'm only a 5'2" woman, I don't know somehow if I gave off some aura of don't mess with me, but very little. And mostly back when I was a student, when there would be that surgeon was inappropriate on a gender issues also. And there were a couple of surgeons that had no problem in the 80s making sexual comments during the OR where you're sitting there with a retractor and you can't do anything. But I have to say, knowing mentors from 10 years prior, what they experienced was worse. That's not to say it's not still going on, and it probably depends on the part of the country, but it might actually be disguised now. So sometimes it might not be as obvious for someone to know to even complain. But I think I was fortunate.
Yeah. Sounds like you were very fortunate. And I mean, I would say that it still happens. I've heard stories of classmates.
Absolutely.
Do you have any advice for women that experience or that find themselves in those kind of situations and how they should go about it, what they should do?
In a couple of the instances where there was one dermatologist that that our medical student used for electives, I went to a mentor, she helped me write a letter. Again, I don't think it went anywhere. The medical student, I mean, it was also a quote-unquote women's medical college, although we were co-ed at that point. Their solution was just to advise students not to take that elective. Which was a shame because it was a 2-week elective and the only other dermatology elective was 4 weeks. And if someone wanted to do dermatology, you know, and they didn't want to commit a month. But I would say there are more women mentors now for the student who doesn't know one. They could probably contact AMWA and be directed to someone in their city or even in their institution. If there's an AMWA chapter, definitely joining that and being, which would have at least one, I forget what they call them, like a physician sponsor. Mm-hmm. Like most AMWA chapters have at least one woman doctor who's their champion. I don't know that for a fact. We actually didn't at my school. We did it on our own, but we had a lot of women faculty. But there's usually that. There's certainly in most cities at least a nominal AMWA chapter or an AMWA regional governor. But reaching out, because most likely you'll find more support than you need, even if it doesn't fix that incident, you at least don't feel like you're alone. And if it's really significant and needs further escalation, there may very well be someone who can help do it. Like there might be a woman dean that isn't necessarily that obvious to anyone, but that would be recommended by AMWA, who would then be able to, you know, take some action, whatever that might be. But if you just kind of keep it to yourself or tell your best friend, it's definitely not going to go anywhere, and it's probably going to affect how you feel about your choice of career.
Yeah, that's
we've had a lot of women show up in an AMWA meeting just for that reason, because they didn't know where else to turn, and they got the support they needed almost always.
Yeah, that's some really valuable advice. I wouldn't have thought of doing that if I ever found myself in a situation like that. But I think you're very right in making that suggestion and advising our listeners that to reach out to AMWA and find the support, just because sometimes just having the support and direction to take the correct steps forward to speak up for yourself can completely make the difference. It's not the same as talking about it with your best friend, as you mentioned.
Right. And I mean, at times AMWA has had workshops on just such things. So sometimes being able to have the best answer next time to a comment. I mean, sometimes there's really severe stuff that happens in people's medical school. Life is in jeopardy, but often it's just having to deal with comments and having the best comeback is empowering. So, I'm definitely a fan of AMWA. I have lifelong friends that sometimes we go to meetings and we just have fun. You know, AMWA has a lot of good lectures, but sometimes we just take the afternoon off and have fun in whatever city we're in. And these are lifelong friends that came and supported me when I had cancer 6 years ago and whatnot. So I can't speak enough about AMWA.
And then my last question, we kind of touched on this already, but I just wanted to say again that I admire that, unlike many of us in medicine, you prioritized yourself alongside your work, and you haven't made your career your entire life. What advice do you have for other women who want to follow your footsteps?
Well, first of all, figure out what other passions you have. There's a woman who opened a clinic at base camp at Mount Everest. And she said something about finding your bliss, which for her was mountain climbing. So she went through residency and she was emergency medicine also, and she was working. And she just realized she needed to climb more. So she found a way of combining her interest in mountaineering and climbing with her medical talents. And it's a major thing. I mean, it provides medical care for the climbers who are trying to summit. And it, along the way, provides a lot of medical care to the Nepalese in the little villages and whatnot. And it's a foundation and all that good stuff. So figuring out what other things might be your passion or your bliss, getting good at them, or at least getting very involved with them, and then figuring out how you can combine it. Now, my way of combining it is not, it's becoming more common, but are you familiar with the concept of locum tenens?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. So locum tenens, for the listeners, is in Latin, means to hold a place. And so it's basically temporary work. And I started doing it early on, right after internship, because, as I said, I was wanting time with my mother. So I couldn't necessarily just take a job in a clinic, because then I would have the same 40 plus hours expectation. So I just did serial part-time jobs so that at a moment's notice, I could say I'm gone and go do whatever my mother needed, and then worked locally toward the end. So that is one thing that I have done for 80% of my career. Post-residency, I had a job for 5 years. And even that was a three-quarters job. So the only thing I would say is that doing it right out of internship was gutsy. And it's not possible now. But right out of residency, it's still a little gutsy because you haven't kind of worked as an attending anywhere. But it's doable. But it's certainly way doable after a year or two of practice. Mm-hmm. And it's very doable in certain specialties, hospitalist medicine, emergency medicine, radiology. The subspecialists all use locums too. So it's actually possible in any specialty. But in emergency medicine, where no one's expecting you per se, it's easy to work someplace for a while and then say, okay, I need some time off. You know, if you still have needs 6 months from now and I'm available, I'd love to come back. Or not. Maybe I didn't like it. I would say I liked almost every place I went. So thinking about a less traditional work schedule, such as locum tenens, or finding a hospital that's willing to hire you as half-time opposite another physician, are some of the options. Of course, then you don't have benefits or health insurance. So that's a whole other issue. But and that's a whole other podcast, because toward the end of my COBRA insurance from residency, before I had made arrangements for more insurance, I realized I had lupus. And in the old days, if you had a diagnosis, you were uninsurable. So that's a whole other podcast. But I was able to cheat the system, so to speak. I was never uninsured. And the lupus wound up being relatively minor, but mild. So finding some passion and then figuring out a way to not be committed to a full-time job might take some searching and looking and talking to sometimes headhunters, but you can't do it if you don't have that. Then you have to have a supportive spouse, and we didn't choose to have children because we were a little older and he already had children. With children, all this gets harder.
Yeah.
And for women, the traveling, I mean, my husband had been married before, he had, you know, his own teaching career. So we were separated a lot more because of the traveling, but it worked. We're still married. So I have a husband who has also a lot of interests, one of which is whitewater kayaking and river guiding. That's how we met. So a more traditional marriage with children and all that that entails might have made what I did a little more difficult. But some variation of that could happen.
Mm-hmm. And definitely, as you were saying, a supportive partner that is willing to support any of the choices that you want to make.
Yeah, I should have said that, supportive partner. I have to get with the lingo. Sometimes I revert back to being an older person. But yeah, supportive partner, family otherwise. I mean, there might be someone that has grandparents in the area that could help with that, as they often do for medical career in general. It kind of seems impossible when you're in the middle of training because it's so overwhelming what they expect of you.
Yeah.
But it does even out after a while, to where you can start making more priorities. And there are definitely more jobs that are open to different arrangements, whether it's part-time, three-quarters time. I was also lucky that once I finally got insurance, not too many years later, when my husband and I got married, I got his insurance. So doing the atypical work pattern didn't impact me because I've had good insurance, and even into semi-retirement and Medicare, I still have good supplemental through him. He used to joke that I had married a handsome man with a good retirement plan or a good health insurance plan or something like that.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, just kind of relating to what you were talking about, how when you're in training, it kind of seems harder to have other interests and hobbies and other things other than medicine, because it almost, the time commitment during training makes it seem almost impossible to do that. And I think I pretty much lost all my hobbies during the first 2 years of medical school, and I slowly had to start setting aside time for them.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Before we close, I always like to ask if you'd like to share anything else with our audience, and if not, that's okay.
Yeah, I think I extemporaneously did that throughout the interview. So I think nothing comes to mind.
Well, thank you again for joining us. I really enjoyed our conversation. And that's a wrap on this episode of Our Voices, Our Future. We hope that today's conversation inspired you, challenged you, and reminded you of the power of raising your voice. The fight for equity doesn't stop here. Join us in the movement. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you love this episode, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Until next time, stay bold, stay vocal, and keep the conversation going. This is Our Voices, Our Future.